Okay, I'm Barry. I'm grateful to be a recovering alcoholic. It's good to see. This is the best looking group of sick people I've seen all day. In the words of Joe McQuaney, one of my mentors, I'll refer to him frequently in my story, we clean up good. I try in the morning when I'm, you know, brushing my teeth, brushing my hair, shaving, doing all that stuff, I try to think of preparing my thinking as I go out to for the day. And some days I do better than others. I'm a little nervous, y'all. I'm going to try to get centered here. My sobriety date this time is March 2nd, 2012. And this is not my first time coming into recovery. I usually, when I come into recovery, it would usually be after getting in some trouble. That's been my pattern. And it hasn't always been something I was willing to do. It was something I knew that if I didn't get sober, that I was going to stay in trouble and go back to prison or go back to jail. I do want to talk a little bit about my recovery before I get started. I am a real alcoholic, and I have recovered. However, it'll take me about 10 minutes to talk myself into drinking. So that's why I always try to remind myself I am recovering, and it's something I have to be proactive and take action to be in recovery. I was born on Labor Day in 1964. Both my parents were very active drinkers. My father was a chemist. My mother was a housewife until she graduated to be a nurse. I put my parents through a lot. It's a wonder to this day to me that my parents, well, my father's passed away, but my mother still loves me unconditionally. My mother is one of my great teachers to this day. I was born in New Jersey. My father was a traveling chemist back in the 60s, and it was popular back then, before the laws changed, for him to go to all the different bottling plants for the company he worked for to test the syrup. Well, then they decided that they were going to have a central beverage base lab in Atlanta, Georgia. So we were my father was transferred down here in 1969, and we moved to Smyrna, Georgia. Some of my first memories when I was living in Maryland, my father, he drank beer a lot, and I would sneak my dad's beer. I mean, 4, 5, 6 years old, if there was a beer sitting down, I would grab it and chug it. And I'd have half that thing chugged before they got a hold of it. And, I mean, I can just remember that, you know, that was just what I thought I was supposed to do, because I saw my dad doing it, and I was like, okay, maybe that's, you know, that's what I'm supposed to do. So I had a taste for alcohol at a very early age. And Christmas Eve, 1969, I have fond memories of this. My mother, not so much. My father was very inebriated, falling down drunk. And my father was funny. He was a fun guy. It was just me and my dad. My brother had gone off to a function for one of the, I think he was in the Cub Scouts or something. My brother was 4 years older than me. And on Christmas Eve, the animals are supposed to talk. So we had all the animals loose in the house. And I don't remember. We had like five or six animals just running all over the house. And my dad was like, okay, they're going to talk. You know, and he had his drinks going, and I'd go sneak. He's like, give me that. And, well, I remember him falling down a lot. And I'd help him get up. I'd say, come on, you can do it, Dad. Well, he knocked the Christmas tree over. Now, back in those days, those light bulbs would get very hot. And I remember, because I was not a normal kid. I would unscrew the bulbs and stick my finger in the socket. Just to... So I was not, you know, what I would call a normal kid. My parents were like, okay, you got to keep the lights up high for Barry. He's got a funny idea what's funny. So my mom was working the graveyard shift at a hospital. When she came home, she got home. It was about 6, 7 o'clock. My dad and I both were laying in the floor. I was hungover too, I think. My mom was not happy. So that was kind of a pattern for my dad. Is he would, you know, he would tie one on occasionally, and it would, you know, it would catch up to him. And I kind of picked up on some of that, and I started doing some of that myself. So when we were transferred to Smyrna, we were Yankees, and you know, we didn't realize how hot it was going to be down here, and we didn't think we were going to need an air conditioner. And my God, I'm glad we got air conditioning. The town I grew up in, there was a lot of construction going on, and I was a troublemaker as a kid. I mean, I would always gravitate to kids that were troublemakers. And this one group of kids, we would go steal wood from the houses and we'd build forts. Well, we were stealing enough wood that they started noticing. I mean, we were building, you know, three-story forts, man. With, you know, it's like, okay, let's build an addition. And we just go get some wood, you know. We're dumb kids. Well, the builder caught us one day. He didn't catch us stealing it. He just caught us with the wood. He said, I'm going to, we didn't get it. We got it from the bikers. And there were some biker gangs that had forts, too. So one of the bikers went to jail. And when he got out of jail, he was not happy. And I remember getting chased through the woods by three of them with machetes. And I could have swore I heard banjos playing. But at any rate. and I was like, man, these people down here, man, they are country. I had a Yankee accent till I hit high school. I fought it and I fought it. And then I finally surrendered. You know, I'm down here. I'm not going back up north. This is a family disease, and I can look at my family and see just about every part of the disease on both ends. And, you know, I've looked at it a little bit more closely the last 3 months because I've been thinking about what was I going to share. And there was a lot of abuse for me growing up, and it took me a long time to forgive my parents and my brother. There are some things that still bother me, but my parents, they did the best they could with what they knew to do. My mother, I don't believe she's going to ever quit drinking. She doesn't have the consequences. It's not that big of a problem for her at this point. So, you know, I give her to God with love and blessings, hoping that, you know, she can find some serenity and happiness. In 1975, we moved to Austell. Now, we thought this was going to be the country. Smyrna was starting to grow up in the 70s. They were widening South Cobb Drive. They were putting an industrial park in. Well, what was funny was in Austell, they also had a big industrial park right on Thornton Road they were building, and I was like, well, this is still not the country. I was real big into skateboarding, and I had an opportunity to go pro when I was 14. Now, by time I was 12, I was already blackout drinking. My whole eighth grade year, I was stealing my dad. My dad would keep a little brown bottle of 200 grain alcohol in his jacket. Now, he would take it and mix it in his beers and make boiler makers. It didn't take much of that alcohol to get really lit. When I was 12, I had already had alcohol poisoning. I almost died from it. My parents didn't know what to do with me. It was easy for them to just kind of say, you know, hopefully this is the last time, don't do this. You know, they didn't really have a pattern to set and say, hey, you can't drink, because, you know, they were doing the same thing. But my whole eighth grade year, my first two classes was science. And I loved science. I don't know if you guys remember the little experiments you do. You'd set up the little things, Iggy says. Well, my little group, there were four of us, we would do what I called, I like to refer to as extreme science. Because I was extremely drunk. So if the ramp was going to be like that, I was like, what if we make it three times longer and make the pitch three times higher? They say to push it, how about we launch it? And my poor teacher, Miss Turnipseed, she was like in her 70s. She didn't know what to do with us. She was just happy we weren't catching stuff on fire, you know. But I had a lot of enablers when I was a kid. You know, back in the 70s, I don't believe we knew what to do with alcoholics like we do now. Looking back, you know, it's a wonder, it's a miracle that I've lived to come up here and tell my story. I would make some very dangerous ramps. And to me, I was a thrill seeker. The more dangerous, the better. And I made this one ramp. And I mean, every time I went up to the top of it, it would kind of just sway. And nobody else in my neighborhood would ride it but me. But that was just kind of, I was crazy. Some of the stuff I would do, skateboarding, was just, it was just insane. The neighborhood we were living in, they had a clubhouse. And there was always a party at that clubhouse. And back then, I mean, you could just, you know, if it was full enough of people, you could just walk in, fix yourself something, and leave. After having the police called a few times, they started tightening that up. My 12th birthday, my brother gave me a bag of pot. And, you know, I looked up to my brother. He was kind of my mentor, and he was real active in drinking and using drugs. Well, we went and saw Aerosmith, Dream On Tour, and I was like, doesn't that guy, the singer, play for another group? I kept getting Aerosmith and Rolling Stones confused because they both looked the same to me. And, you know, of course, I was after eight of those Miller Pony beers. they bought 2 8-packs, and I was sitting in the back, and by the time we got to the Omni, I drank one of them by myself. They were not happy. And I was just getting started. my alcoholism is also being supplemented by drug use at this point. I hung out with people that were older than me that liked to do those sort of things. When I was 14, I stole my mother's car, took it for a joyride. My daughters heard this. I didn't know the brakes were not good on this car. You know, it didn't stop me from, wouldn't have stopped me. And I sideswiped a Camaro. Now I was in a Chevette. Four-cylinder, four-speed, okay? And I'm trying to outrun this thing. Well, this happened to Douglas County. They caught me in Cobb. And I knew I was screwed when a pregnant woman stepped out. I was like, oh, my God, this is going to be really bad. My father bailed me out of that. It was expensive, and this was kind of setting a pattern of my behavior with my parents. They bailed me out as much as they could. At this time, I had a friend that worked at a local pharmacy, and I told him, I said, you need to wait to take anything, because then they won't link it to you. You know, just let's study this. Let's learn what the good stuff is. And so my mom had a PDR. I said, here, study this. So we're becoming pharmacists now, you know. You know, 14, 15, 16-year-old pharmacists. So needless to say, he had access to the inventory after about 6 months. They trusted him. He was stealing bottles of stuff. And, you know, we were experimenting with muscle relaxer, speed. I mean, we were some teenage pill heads. And we had some incidents at school where, you know, don't take the green ones. You know, you don't take the green ones. You're not going to make it. And, of course, you know, wait till you get home. And then we'd find out somebody was, you know, carried to the principal's. Oh, he took the green ones. Shouldn't have taken the green ones. We called them greeny meanies back then. I wanted to be a drug dealer when I was a teenager. And this is kind of back when the Miami Vice thing was going on. It was kind of, you know, cool. And I got caught selling pot at school. And I was stoned when they caught me. I should have gotten caught way. It just took them way too long to catch me. I mean, I walked around with a backgammon case full of joints. And we pretend we're playing backgammon. You don't play backgammon in a minute, you know. You know. And, man, I'm going to tell you, once you get caught for something like that in high school, you are branded. I mean, when I got suspended and I came back, man, I was a kingpin. I mean, there were so many rumors flying around. And people look at you different when you become, I was notorious, as they said. And I was like, okay, great. And at this point, my grades were really starting to slip. I mean, I started skipping school a lot. I hated school. It was just a bunch of, I don't know, it was, school was not for me as a teenager. I'd rather, you know, go meditate on the pipeline and, you know, drop acid. That was what I was good at. I did find out, I took a psychology class as an elective, and they gave us an IQ test. And when we took our IQ test, they gave everybody theirs back but mine. And I was like, damn, I must have done pretty bad, you know? And the teacher said, don't worry about it. We'll discuss it at a later time. And then at the end of the class, she said, Barry, at the end of the semester, she said, Barry, stay after. I want to talk to you. She came and sat down with me. And she said, you tested genius level. And she proceeded to try to enter me into gifted curriculum. And I was like, whoa, 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 you're cutting into my getting high time now. No, I've got too much homework as it is. And, you know, since then, I kind of looked at things a little bit different. I was like, God, that's why I'm such a know-it-all brat. You know, you could tell me something, but, you know, as you're telling it to me, I've already got it figured out how I'm going to improve on it. And, you know, I just had my mind made up of what I was going to do. I was a smart-ass know-it-all brat. I was getting beat up a lot as a kid. I was not a fighter. I had a mouth on me, and it's a wonder I didn't get beat up even more than I did. So my sophomore year, after getting caught, I got beat up by the football team a lot. I would miss the bus because I would stay up so late partying. And my dad got tired of coming and picking me up, taking me to school. So I started walking to work, to school. And school was about 6 miles away. And I have to cut through a pipeline. Well, then I started jogging. Then I started running. And I got to where I could run pretty fast. I was like, okay, these guys are going to beat me up. They're going to have to catch me first. And I went out for soccer, and now I was not an athletic kid at all. I could pitch really well, but I was not athletic. So I was the sixth fastest runner in the whole school on the cross country. And so everybody wanted me to go out track, soccer, football. But I didn't want to. I just want to get high. You know, it was seemed like the right thing to do at the time. Well, I played soccer 1 year, and I'm going to tell you, I ran my ass off. I mean, that sport. I mean, you think you're running when you run to work, man? Run to school, and boy, that's a tough sport there. After I got caught at school being notorious, it was hard for me to keep good grades. Even if I had a good grade, they did not want to give me a good grade. They weren't going to. One of my teachers was a coach, and I always did good in science. He gave me a D. I know I had a solid B, and when I took my grade to him, he said, we won't have any drug dealers in our school making better than a D. And I was like, okay. So I decided to go to an open campus school at this time. Now, the open campus school, they treated you like an adult. You were allowed so many absentees, and you didn't have to have a doctor's excuse or anything. That was something I got good at, was writing my own excuses. I learned early on, if you start writing your own excuse, they never suspected it was forged. So that's how I got away with skipping a lot of school. I just wrote my own excuse. So I applied to this open campus school, and I went one summer before I got caught because I had failed 3 U.S. histories and 1 world geography. I hated social studies. I was probably one of the most antisocial people at the time, and social studies just didn't sound like anything I wanted to learn. So I took my social studies classes, and I really liked the school because there wasn't a lot of personalities. There wasn't the jocks. There wasn't the dope heads. You know, everybody was pretty much just there to get their credits and get the hell out. And so that's what I did. My senior year, I would have had to go all day and be only able to fail one class. And when I went to this open campus school, I got out early my senior year, and I got the privilege of graduating from two schools. When I went back to graduate from my regular high school, they thought I had died. They were like, "Where have you been?" And I said, "Been out selling dope. You need some?" Through my teenage years, I would black out a lot. And when I blacked out, sometimes I would come to and I would be in a situation that I didn't remember getting myself into. Now, as a kid, some of the people I hung out with, they were entertainers and they were homosexuals. And I didn't think a whole lot about it, you know, and I would come to and I would be with somebody in their bed and I would say, "Whoa, wait a minute." Now, I was scared to death of women as a kid. I mean, I blame it on my mother. She was mean. She had to be mean to put up with me, man. And, you know, I don't fault her for that. So I'm cruising through my teenage years, and I'm questioning, am I gay? You know, I'm attracted to women, but, man, they scare the hell out of me. And so I question that because I've never been intimate with a woman. Well, finally, I found somebody that would get drunk enough with me to get intimate with me. And then I kind of put that out of my mind. I was like, okay, I'm not gay now. You know, but for a long time, I was like, man, am I gay? You know, I'm attracted to women, but they scare the hell out of me. You know, I got to admit, y'all still scare the hell out of me. I think that's my mom stuff there. So, my first girlfriend, she put up with a lot. Her, and I can pick them, man. Her husband was in prison. And she was like, "This is just temporary, cool it, you know." I was ready to get married, you know. "Woohoo, let's get married. Let's settle down." And she's like, "Whoa, cowboy." And that was kind of my behavior. You know, it's all or nothing, man. There's nothing in the middle. My brother and I got in a big fight. And he had beat me up so bad. Until I was 17, I finally had enough. Man, I whooped him into next week. And when I did that, it scared everybody. It even scared me. I could have killed him, but I stopped. And my parents feared for everybody's safety. And so one day, I'm getting up. Sheriff knocks at my door. They're taking me to Ridgeview. Now, when I went to Ridgeview, I had already been seeing a psychiatrist, a sociologist. I was going to group therapy. When I got caught selling weed, you know, they sent me to NA. And, you know, that whole period of my life, I was the problem. And, you know, they didn't want to look at their part. So I was in Ridgeview. And when I went to Ridgeview, I had some acid in my wallet, and when I found out I was going into Ridgeview, I was like, I'm not going to let them get that, so I took all three hits. And I was able to keep them from knowing, and after I'd been there for about 2 months, I got honest, and they were going to let me out until I got honest with them. I signed myself out when I was 18. Now it was AMA against medical advice, but I was 18. They let me sign myself out. I stayed sober probably for 6 or 9 months. Now I was not ready to get sober at this point. I still had a lot of partying to do. within a year, I was back at Ridgeview. And this time, I was on the adult unit. And this time, it was going to be different. For about 9 months. I had self-knowledge at this point, and I thought that I knew enough to where I was going to be able to be okay going to meetings. I have been arrested so many times, I can't keep track. I tried to plot this stuff out, and by the time I was 21, I had been convicted of 3 DUIs, been charged with habitual violator twice, and by the time I was 21, I was going to prison for the first time. And when I went to prison, I found religion. And religion, for me, kept me out of a lot of trouble. I was called to serve the Lord. And when I was very devout. But I had this thing called alcoholism that, you know, the church, they didn't know how to deal with that. They would say, drunkenness is a sin, so if you can have a few, you're good. And that's what I learned there. People used to hate to see me coming because I would have a Bible and they'd say, oh God, here comes Barry. And I was going to save the world, man. And I couldn't even save myself. The second time I went to prison, I had burned the bridge down of my parents. They had had enough. They said, you're not coming back here. You need to work something else out. So I went through a diversion center. When I went through that diversion center, they made us save up enough money to get our own place. Well, I had 2 people that were in the cell with me that really made me look at myself. One was somebody that was, he had killed a family of 5 drinking. And this guy cried himself to sleep every night. Now, it's a miracle that that was not me. The kind of drinking I did, I would black out and drive. I regularly think about that person, where they're at today, because he would cry himself to sleep, and he would say, you know, what they've sentenced me is nothing. You know, he's got to live with this the rest of his life. And, you know, he said, I don't know how I'm going to, you know, ever live with this. I'm going to fast forward to 1989. I was on probation in 3 counties, parole for the state. I hadn't had a driver's license since 1982. I was getting ready to go back to prison for the 3rd time. And this gentleman came up to me and he asked me, I was really distraught, I was crying. He said, would you like to pray? And I said, oh man, I said, would I ever? And we prayed. And he taught me about forgiveness. And he taught me that forgiveness and love is kind of the key to getting through all this stuff. And he saw that I was sincere, so he allowed me to go through a program back then. It was a year program. It was called CARP, Comprehensive Alcoholic Rehabilitation Program. Now, this is God doing for me what I could have never done for myself. This program, they used the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The program they used was developed by Joe McQuaney of Joe and Charlie. It's called Recovery Dynamics. Now, the class I was in, we started with about 40 people. And at the end of the 17 weeks, there were 3 of us. I was one of the 3. And when I graduated, you know, it had so much depth, and I could see that this is what was going to save my life. I said, well, you know what? I'm going to take it again. I've got a year here. You know, couldn't hurt. So I'm taking the second class, and the guy that was teaching it, he was a volunteer. He got sick, and he couldn't teach it. So they were going to cancel it. And I asked them if I could teach the class. And they said, well, sure. You went through. You graduated. Why not? So I taught that class for a year. And being a selfish, self-centered person, right at the end of a year, I got into an argument with a Muslim. It was a matter of personal stuff. I was being very selfish and self-centered. A lot of people like to refer to it as the Holy War because I was a Christian, he was a Muslim. It's like, where are y'all going to have another Holy War? I was like, let it go. And it was just me being me and not getting my way is why I got kicked out. Now, I was facing going back to prison, and I was able to finagle not going back to prison. And I moved in with somebody that had, he had 12 years sobriety, but he was a pothead. Now, I didn't know this at the time, that one of the groups I was going to, people with 20 years were potheads. I was like, yeah, I'm not the only one. This person, this one. I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, okay, that's in my mind. I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking, maybe I can smoke weed, you know? That didn't work out too well for me. I'm one of those people that I'm either all in or I'm not. And for me, a drink, a drug, is just a symptom of my spiritual sickness. And if one's good, man, 10 has got to be better. At this time, I had met someone that had about 9 months. I took her hostage. We were shacking up together. She shortly after we got together started drinking again. And then she would disappear for days. She was a crackhead, and I tried getting her back into recovery, and after 3 times I had surrendered, I told her parents, I can't do anything with her, you need to come get her. All the while, I'm smoking weed, thinking that, you know, I can handle it. I had a domestic violence charge at that time. Now, she would drink a lot. She had bruises all over, and I pushed her, and she tripped, and she hurt her arm. She called the cops, and she didn't want them to take me to jail. She just wanted to make me go. And I said, okay. And they said, you're going okay. And every one of her bruises I was responsible for. Now, I managed to get out of that by going through anger management. Now, anger management, man, that's a whole nother thing there. I mean, you know, I realized after that, I am responsible. You know, for me to say that you made me get mad, no. We are responsible for our feelings, and the sooner we learn that, the healthier we can be. I'm going to fast forward here, y'all. In 1996, I went back to school. I got certified to do heating and air conditioning. I learned how to make a lot of money. My drinking and drug use progressed rapidly. I started freebasing cocaine. That'll take you down real quick. And I still think I'm suffering from a lot of the effects of that, as well as my alcohol usage to this day. I'm surprised a lot of days that I have any faculties left. That's debatable, right? I met my daughter's mother in 2000. I took her hostage. And we were engaged to get married. We were both drinkers. We were both partiers. I figured, you know, hey, this is going to be perfect. And we had my daughter. At the time, I was not excited, but I have learned to embrace the opportunity to have my daughter. She's my greatest teacher and probably my greatest blessing. Her and I were fighting a lot, and we split up. And I thought that we were going to get back together, but the damage was done. There was no chance of us getting... She could not forgive me, and I understand that. I've made my amends with her. She still is not able to forgive me, and, you know, that's okay. I still love her just the same. Since I've been back in recovery this time, I'm learning how much of a miracle it is that we are all here. You know, just getting here is half the battle. And I'm going to tell you, it's a whole lot easier staying here than coming back. I am learning to treasure every moment of my recovery as my last, because there's no guarantee when my thinking is going to get the best of me. I've, in the last 6 months, probably thought of drinking more than I ever have. And I think it's probably because, you know, I'm an alcoholic. It's just normal. I know now that my drinking and my drug usage is just a symptom of what's really going on. You know, I use the 12 steps for, you know, all parts of my life now. I have some issues that I'm dealing with that are not alcohol or drug related. They're personal. And I'm looking at myself saying, you know what? I thought that this was just about not drinking, and it's not. The newcomer is very important to me, because I believe that if I don't share what's been freely given to me, I will not continue to receive what God's will is for me. I believe that God's will is for me to serve Him and my fellow human being. And what better person to help an alcoholic than somebody that's as nuts as me? I got a lot of blank pages here, y'all. I think I was in a blackout then. Big blur. Look at that. Nothing. 2008. 2000. Okay. I would like to close with this. Where is it? I was going to fill this group up with a bunch of people reading stuff so I wouldn't have to share so much. But apparently we have this thing called group conscience. You know, I think of my recovery as a paradox. And when I think of recovery, I think of the paradoxes. And probably the one that sticks out to me the most is we die to live. Now, for me, in trying to stay in God's will, there's parts of me that I still am struggling with. And, you know, what am I willing to give up to do God's will? And it's a challenge. There's parts of me that, you know, certain days I'm like, okay, God, you can have that. And then other days it's like, oh, no, I'm not doing that. So it's a paradox. I will close with this. This is where I try to stay. This keeps me centered. It's the 11th step prayer. And I'm going to shorten it. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. I know the first part. And it goes on and on and on. It is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. when I can have that attitude, I have a chance. And I need you guys. I need the fellowship. And it's been an honor and a privilege to be given this opportunity. And thank you for this opportunity.